after wishing everyone Boker Tov, and thank you for coming. There are various types of fertility treatments that have to be analyzed from a halachic perspective.
You have to talk into the mic for some of.
And one of them is going to be surrogate motherhood.
Okay.
Now, the push here is for the mitzvah, the great mitzvah of Piri Varivya, of bringing children into the world. And we see in halacha that there's a tremendous emphasis on this mitzvah. Chazal call it a mitzvah rabba, a great mitzvah. And that description is used only rarely for very specific mitzvahs. The first of which is Piri Varivya, bringing children into this world. So that the whole enterprise of fertility treatment should be understood in the light of halacha as something of top priority. The Gemara tells us that normally we're not allowed to sell a Sefer Torah, but for the sake of Piri Varivya, if necessary, to facilitate a marriage relationship, we're going to do that. The Gemara tells us that for the sake of Piri Varivya, if need be, we're going to allow a master to free his slave, an Eved Knani, which normally is prohibited, and many other heterim that we'll have to be matir to permit various prohibitions that normally would apply for the sake of Piri Varivya. That's the great mitzvah. It's really up on top of the list. It's not just the first mitzvah chronologically, but it has a great significance. A lot of the stories in Sefer Bereishis revolve around this mitzvah, about bringing children into the world. Now, the classical case of fertility treatment, which would be beyond question, meaning it would be absolutely acceptable and required, would be what we call IVF. Let me just describe this. In vitro fertilization, an ovum is removed from the wife, the sperm from the husband, and fertilization takes place in the lab, in a container. And that fertilized embryo is now implanted into the wife. The reason for that as a treatment is because this is the only way that they can achieve conception. In this case, clearly the halacha would not only permit but require such a treatment, because she's carrying the baby, it's her ovum, it's his sperm, husband and wife, the mitzvah Piri Varivya. And this has become almost standard practice, ma'isim b'chol yom, as we say, so common in the world of fertility treatment and in the Orthodox world itself. We have neighbors where we live, their son is already married, he was born in this way, IVF. So what is our issue today? This is a more complicated case. We're talking about surrogacy. We're talking about a case where following the IVF, meaning it was his sperm, her ovum, the conception took place outside, and now this, we'll call it a zygote, this conception is now injected into a woman who's going to carry the baby. She's the surrogate mother, she's going to give birth to the baby. And after the embryo is implanted into the surrogate mother, which is often the case of a woman who cannot carry to term, full to term, she cannot have the entire pregnancy followed by birth. Classically, it's because of a disease that she may suffer from, which is called MRKH syndrome. Very often it's because of a back problem, which doesn't allow her to carry the baby a full term. And the physicians in this case, within the context of fertility treatment, will advocate in favor of surrogacy. I wouldn't say that surrogacy is maisim b'chol yom. It's not something that happens daily. But it has become quite common in fertility treatment. And just to tell you a story, back, I would say, about 15 years ago, because the boy that I'm talking about is already 15 years old, it's hard to believe, a couple came to me, he's a student of mine, a very close Talmud of mine, and asked me about the opportunity, the possibility of surrogacy. His wife could not carry to term. There was no problem of conception, but the problem was that the physicians told her it would be very dangerous for her to carry the full pregnancy and give birth. So again, I wouldn't say it's every day, but it's become quite common. It's not rare anymore. Now, there are a number of different issues that the halacha has to address with regard to surrogacy. We're going to start our discussion today with a list of these issues. The first issue is going to be the permissibility of such a treatment. Is it halachically permissible for a couple to have their fetus being carried by a surrogate mother? And if so, who is the surrogate mother? Is she Jewish? Is she not Jewish? And we'll see soon that in very often in cases of fertility treatment of this sort, we advocate in favor of a non-Jewish woman, and we'll have to try to understand why. So that's the first issue: is it permitted? And Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, one of the great poskim of our generation, has addressed this issue in an essay in Tchumin. And I have to thank the OU Center for being kind enough to copy this over. There are many copies. If anybody doesn't have one, we have one here. Again, it's written in what we call the Lamdisha Hebrew, so that those who want an English translation, to the best of my knowledge, Tchumin has not been translated into English, which I wish it would be at some point. That would give the articles, the brilliant chidushim of this journal, a much wider reading audience. It would help me personally, because I myself have published a few times in Tchumin. And he, Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, is going to be the first to really tackle this issue. And if you take a look quickly at the first paragraph, you will see that when he presents the question, he lists the following issues, all based on the fundamental question, who is the mother of the child? In Hilchus Yuchsin, in terms of relationships, this becomes critical to determine who is the mother. Is it the genetic mother, meaning the woman who's, we call it the balas habetza, means her ovum, or is it the birth mother? So what are the differences in halacha? He offers the following list. And he says the following. The first difference in halacha, which is perhaps the most profound and the most significant, is what's called the Iser Erva, which means that if two individuals are related, let's say, for example, a brother and a sister, that's an erva relationship. If they would have a marriage relationship or a relationship of intimacy, that would cause what we call mamzerus. That would be a violation of an iser kares, of the most severe kind of prohibition. So now we have to determine who is the mother. If the mother is the genetic mother, then the child would not be allowed to marry, for example, let's say the child is a male, his sister who was born to that same genetic mother, because that's the erva called achoso, his sister. If, on the other hand, his mother is the birth mother, then he's not related at all to the children, to a sister, so to speak, a girl who was born to the genetic mother, and vice versa. So this, of course, is a very severe issue. But Rav Zalman Nechemya goes way beyond that. And he tells us that we have to ask, laws of, number one, Yerusha, inheritance. Who will inherit if this child ultimately dies? Which mother will inherit the child? And in the flip side, if these two mothers or one of the two dies, would he have rights to inherit? Which mother is the mother? Number two, he wants to know what happens in the case that I mentioned earlier, where one mother is Jewish, the other mother is not. What is the status of the child? If the child is being brought into the fold and being raised as a Jew or a Jewess, does that child require conversion, gerus? And it all depends on who the mother is, because one of the two mothers is Jewish. Another difference is about the law of pidyon haben. What does that mean, pidyon haben? The requirement is that the firstborn needs pidyon, the five sloim that are given to the kohen. Well, what happens if one mother is giving birth for the first time, the other mother has never given birth, and the other mother has given birth in the past? Well, let's determine who the mother is, and then we can determine whether the child has the status of a bechar and would require pidyon haben. He goes on to describe other nafkaminas, other differences in halacha as far as psulei kol are concerned, or mamzerus. And all this depends on determining who is the mother. Now, I want to give the following introduction, and I'm hoping that by the end of this presentation, within the time that we are allowed, we'll understand why this introduction is very relevant. The Yerushalmi says that, and this is the Yerushalmi in Masechet Chagiga, in the first perek, that there's a principle. If you have any halachic issue, and certainly this issue is a very definite halachic issue with all these ramifications, and it's very complex to come up with an answer to this question, where do you turn for the answer? So the Yerushalmi says that the entire gamut of Torah literature is divided into two very strict and different, fundamentally different classifications. One is called halacha, and the other is called agadata. Agadata means writings that are more philosophical in nature. Shas is made up of two components. The vast majority of shas is made up of halachic principles, but there's a very significant part of shas. And let's add to that other agadic statements which come from midrashim. These are non-halachic sources. And the Yerushalmi establishes that with regard to any halachic question, we have to refer to halachic sources. Agadic sources are unacceptable as far as determining halacha. So if I were to make a meticulous reading in a medrash and come to some conclusion that the medrash presupposes a certain premise which is halachic in nature, because this statement is made within the context of agadita and not in halachic sugya and shas, we cannot rely on it. We cannot invoke, according to the Yerushalmi, a non-halachic source, which is called a medrash or an agada, in order to determine halacha. This has tremendous repercussions. For example, one of the great poskim amongst the Ashkenazic Jews about three centuries ago, the Nodav Yehuda, he adheres strictly to this rule of the Yerushalmi. He refuses to introduce any medrashim or any agadic statements into a halachic debate, a halachic discussion. However, and here's the point that I want to emphasize, none other than Rabbi Kiva Eger, who lived two centuries ago, and he is a major source of halachic psak for Ashkenazim, he writes that in certain cases, in certain very strict situations, we could rely on agadita, on midrashim. And he says that in event that there are no classical sources in the Talmud, in the halachic part of the Talmud, to respond to give us a basis for a conclusion, then we're allowed to use agadat. And this principle was accepted by none other than Rav Avadi Yosef, who's one of the great poskim of our generation, as you know. And he wrote a myriad of svarim. And very often, not rarely, he quotes an agadic source to support a halachic position. So that as we embark on this discussion, an analysis of who is the mother, is it the genetic mother or the birth mother? Now that we have this technology where you can take a fetus and transfer it over to another woman who's now going to give birth to that one, carry this fetus during its pregnancy, is this embryo belong to the genetic mother whose ovum was given here, or to the birth mother? If we end up at the end of our discussion that there is no source in the halachic literature in Talmud, then, at least according to Rabbi Akiva Eiger and following him, Rabbi Avadi Yosef, we can invoke agadic sources, and that's going to be extremely important for our discussion today. Having said this, we're ready for Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg. Are there any Talmudic sources that address this question of surrogate motherhood? So if you'll open up to page 2 of this handout, again, I'm only saying this to those who would like to follow the text inside. If not, it's fine. If it's Torah Shebaal Peh, that's good enough. In the main paragraph, on the second page, which you'll look on the top left, it says page 249 in Tchumin, which is a wonderful journal, as I mentioned earlier, Rabbi Akiva Eiger says that he found a source for this issue. Now, in order to appreciate his analysis here, we have to know a sugya in Masechet Chulin. Now, Masechet Chulin spends a major chunk of time on what's called basar b'cholav, a mixture of meat and milk. The Torah says, lo tevashel gedi b'chalev imo. Now the word imo has to be underlined in our context, because we want to know who is the imo, who is the mother. Now what does this mean? The Gemara establishes that not all milk is milk, which is very interesting. There's something that you and I would call biologically milk. There's no question if you put it under a microscope, you would say it's got exactly the same identical physical content as any milk. But yet, halachically, it's not called milk. And the significance of that is that at least on a Torah level, you'd be allowed to take that milk and cook meat with that milk, because it's not cholav halachically. You know, here's a perfect example of entering into the halachic abstract universe, which is predicated on the assumption that not everything that meets the eye is halachically true. That there are legal categories that halacha operates with which do not reflect what we call the metzius, the physical reality. So I can have something that is identical to milk, it tastes like milk, it looks like milk, but it's not milk. And the difference is that at least on a Torah level, I'd be allowed to cook meat with milk. So what is this milk that's not milk? Okay. And this is called cholav mesa. What it means is that you slaughter a cow, and you find milk in the udders of the cow. That milk, again, just by, shall we say, accident, was not removed from the body of the cow during its lifetime, and we discovered it and we removed it after the death of the cow. And the Chazal, based on drushos and the word imo, determine that that milk is not called milk. Now, why is that milk not called milk? So the Gemara says the following. This is the principle. That since the Torah describes this milk as chalav imo, it's got to be milk that's taken from an animal that could be a mother. So if you have a cow that could be a mother, and you extract the milk from that cow, that is chalav. But if the cow has already died, that cow is now considered eino roi laholada. It doesn't have the possibility, obviously, after death, of giving birth. It cannot produce a calf. And since it cannot be roi laholid, therefore, it's not called imo. And if it's not called imo, then the chalav, the milk, is not called chalav, because the Torah describes and qualifies the milk in this context of the Iser of basam chalav as chalav imo. And imo means imo re'uya laholit. Now what we're going to study, and you'll see it here in this first paragraph, is something called a trefa. A trefa is an animal, let's take the case of a cow, that's walking on all fours. And ostensibly, again, in terms of what meets the eye, the cow is absolutely healthy. But in truth, the cow is not healthy at all. The cow is going to die. It may take up to 12 months until the cow will die. The cow is called a trefa. If you go ahead and slaughter that cow, you're not allowed to eat its meat. And now what we want to study is what's called Hagos Rabbi Kiveger. Rabbi Kiveger, as I said, lived about two centuries ago, and he wrote comments on the Shulchan Aruch. Now, the Shulchan Aruch in Yoredeah dedicates Simon Pei Zayin to the laws of Lo Tevashel Gdi B'Chalev Imo. And there, Rabbi Kiveger raises the following question. What's the status? I have to apologize to those who are sitting on my right. If I move the microphone a little bit, I'll probably be able to move my head both to the right and the left. Yeah, no, it's not that. I know you could hear me because I hear myself, so you must be able to hear me. No, I'm just joking. But what I mean is I like to see the audience. You know, I like to make eye contact. But the microphone is sort of bothering me a little bit. But let's hope that we can get by. I'm not used to using a microphone, but we'll survive it. So what goes on here in the case of a trefa? You extract milk from a cow that's alive. I wouldn't say alive and well, because the animal is a trefa. Would that milk be chalav? Would it be considered chalav ha'em? So the comment here is that of Rabbi Kiveger. Rabbi Kiveger analyzes this case. Now, watch it. This case was never brought up in the Gemara, which is mind-boggling. The first to analyze this case was Rabbi Kiveger, who lived two centuries ago. I would call that contemporary Jewish life almost. It's modern history. And he wants to know what's the status of the milk of a trefa. And he points out that a trefa ain't a yoledes. A trefa cannot give birth. In other words, because of the injury to one of its vital internal organs, which makes it into a trefa, the animal, the cow in this case, is not healthy enough to give birth. However, based on various sources, Rabbi Kiveger proves that although the cow, because it's a trefa, cannot give birth, it's not healthy enough to give birth to a calf, but nevertheless, it's re'uya lehis'aber, which means that even though the animal is a trefa, it can become pregnant. It will not be able to carry to term and give birth to this calf. Now again, if we had another month, we would study all the sources and have to analyze them and investigate them. So at this point, we need what's called emunas chachamim. We have to believe Rabbi Kiveger and see, you know, if we can accept all his analysis, all his sources, and so forth. But based on his analysis, he proves that the status of a trefa is that of an animal that can become pregnant but cannot carry to term. This sounds very familiar to us in our discussion about surrogate motherhood, because this fertility treatment called surrogate motherhood is most pressing in the case of a woman who cannot carry to term. So Rabbi Kiveger says the following. What's the status of this cow, which is, or she is, a trefa? Meaning, what's the status of the milk of this cow? It's not like the case of milk that was extracted from a cow after you slaughtered the cow. That's a mesa. And in the case of chalav mesa, because ain ruyu laholid, certainly the chalav is not called chalav. But in this case, of a trefa, we don't know how to classify it. Should we define it as equal to a mesa, meaning that since this cow cannot give birth, therefore it's considered a like a chalav mesa, meaning there's no emo, because the Torah describes the chalav with the adjective of emo. Or should we say no? That since the cow has the ability to become impregnated and carry the fetus, the embryo of a calf, that's enough to make the cow considered emo. And therefore the chalav becomes chalav emo, and it's included in the prohibition of basar b'chalav. Says Rabbi Kiveger that he found in a sefer called the Isur V'Heter. Now, the Isur V'Heter was an Ashkenazi sefer that dates back almost 5 centuries. It's a major source for halacha. And Rabbi Kiveger says that he found, by reading meticulously an Isur V'Heter, you and I would never have discovered this, he says that chalav trefa is considered basar b'chalav d'oraisa. And why is that? Because the chalav of a trefa, the trefa is considered re'uya lios em, that she is considered em. Why is she considered em, says Rabbi Kiveger? The Gemara says, the principle that we're operating with, this is our premise, she cannot come to full term and give birth. Ah, says Rabbi Kiveger, the answer is, why is this considered em? And the chalav, therefore, is chalav aim included in the isur basar b'chalav. It must be because the treif is capable of being impregnated. And that makes her into, or the chalav into chalav aim makes her into an aim. So at what point in time, what makes this cow into an aim? Is it birth or is it pregnancy? Conception. What's the answer? Conception. Says Rabbi Kiveger, you see clearly from the isur v'heter that a woman is considered aim. Again, in this case, we're talking about a cow, but the same, we can extrapolate and compare it to a female, a human being, that she is considered an aim. Why? Because she can become impregnated. She can never come to full term and give birth. That's not necessary. The condition that's necessary to establish imahut, which we would call in English motherhood, is the ability to become pregnant. And that makes her into an aim. And that's called Re'uya Laholid. Again, she's not Re'uya Laholid in terms of Leda, but she's Re'uya Laholid Lihis Aver, to become pregnant and carry a fetus. And that itself is enough to generate the status of an aim. And if we would end that discussion right here, I'd have to tell you that the genetic mother is considered the aim. Why? Because Imahut, motherhood, is determined and established by pregnancy, by the possibility of the female's ovum being impregnated and she carries the fetus.
Excuse me.
Yeah, please.
I don't see it, how that follows. All you're establishing there is that this cow is capable of being a mother. The question is whether the surrogate mother is capable of being a mother. Question is, this the surrogate mother, the mother of this child?
Here's the deal. Everything you said is 100% correct, as we'll soon see in Rav Shlomo Zalman, in Rav Zalman Nechemya. But Rav Zalman Nechemya is interested in answering a slightly different question than the one you're posing. You're focused, I'm sorry, I don't know your name.
Bernard Wolfson.
What is your name, Wolf?
Wolfson,
okay, Rabbi Wolfson is poetry. You're not a rabbi. Okay, I gave you smicha now, right? So he's posing the following question: could the surrogate mother be considered a mother? Rabbi Kiveger right now is asking a slightly different question. He's going to get to your question in just a few minutes. The question he's asking is, would the pregnancy mother, the mother whose ovum was conceived, and now she has a fetus, an embryo, would she be considered a mother? Meaning, is it enough of a, let's say we'll call it candidacy, is the genetic mother a candidate for being called a mother? We'll get to the surrogate mother in just a minute. But as far as the establishment of, or the answer to the question, would the genetic mother, if you're following me, be considered a candidate for a mother, even though she never gave birth to the embryo? Here's where Rabbi Kiveger quotes the Isur V'Heter. Since the Isur V'Heter establishes the status of the chalav here, in the case of a trefa, to be that of chalav imo, And therefore this milk of the treifas is included in the Iser of Basar B'Chalav. It must be that, and this premise you have to grant me, that even though there's no possibility of this woman carrying a full term, again, when I say a woman, you know, this is another issue that has to be analyzed, because Rav Shlomo Zalman was his father-in-law. But I mean to say, Rav Zalman Nechemia, please correct me, if I ever say Rav Shlomo Zalman, I mean Rav Zalman Nechemia. He's assuming, and this itself is a premise, that we can make an equation between animals and human beings. Meaning, once the Torah used the word aim in one context, even though it's not referring to a human female, it's referring to, in this case, to a cow, but it's called chalav imo, that defines aim even for human beings. So if you accept that premise, how could we call this milk that was extracted from a treifa chalav imo if the treifa is ainu ru'i laholit? And the answer is, according to Issa v'Hetta, because the treifa is ru'i lis aber. So at least let's grant Rav Zalman Nechemia this conclusion. In other words, we're not excluding the surrogate mother yet. You know, we have to deal with that. But at least if someone were to argue, and many poskim take this position, that the genetic mother, insofar as she was excluded from Leida, could not be considered the mother of this child, and let's forget about the ovum for 1 minute, that, says Rabbi Kivega, comes contradicts straight away the principle that we derive from the Issa v'Hetta. Yes? For sure, we didn't get this question yet about the surrogate mother, right?
No, aside from the question of the surrogate mother, because showing that a cow can be considered an egg versus its imo, his mother, the might not have realized that it's an cow, but still be considered in the general category of mother cows, because we see that theoretically.
So you're making the following distinction. If we're dealing with the status of the cow, then Rav Zalman Nechemia is right. The cow must be considered emo. She's bichlal, she's included in aim, because she's ru'uya laholit. Now we have to ask a different question. Well, what's the relationship between the vlad and that aim? Okay, and that's your question over here, because Rav Zalman Nechemia has still not convinced us that the child definitely is miyuchas, is related to the genetic mother. We know that the genetic mother might be considered the aim, and that's a very, very profound statement about the status of the mother as an aim, even though there's no possibility of leida. But do we know that the child that's going to be born? So, for example, forget about surrogate motherhood. Let's say we would take this fetus and grow it in an incubator. Would that child, once it's born, be considered the ben, the son of this mother, of Imo? Well, she's considered Imo, in a sense, but I don't know if that's enough to establish Yichus. Maybe for that we need to go a step further, and we need a second condition, and that's Leida. Okay, give me a few minutes, just only because I want to get to my punchline here. Rav Zalman Nechemia, at this point in the conversation, and here you might want to fast forward to page 252. Again, there's a lot of lumdus here in between. Now quotes another sefer. Now this sefer is much later than Rebbe Kivega. So it's fascinating. You know, the whole issue of surrogate motherhood, which is first being analyzed by Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, begins with sources that are contemporary almost. Because this sefer that he's going to be quoting on this page was written by Rav Yosef Engel. He wrote many svarim, one of which is called the Beis Ahotzar. And Rav Yosef Engel lived about a century ago. Now, doesn't that fascinate you? It fascinates me that in order to analyze a very relevant halachic issue, we have to go back into history for about 100 years. That's all. I mean, what happened to the Talmud? You know what I'm saying? It's just a pella. It's just unbelievable. So what did Rav Yosef Engel have to say that might be relevant to our discussion? He bases himself on a Gemara in Masechta Megillah on Daf Yud Gimel Amud Aleph. The Gemara there is addressing a few extra words, or at least at first glance, what seem to be a few superfluous words in Megillas Esther. And the pasuk here is describing Esther in the context of her relationship with Mordechai. You may remember that Mordechai adopted Esther because she was an orphan. However, the Torah seems to repeat itself. In this case, when I say the Torah, I mean the Tanakh, meaning Ksuv, meaning Megillas Esther, seems to repeat itself unnecessarily. And every word in the Tanakh, no matter where it is in Tanakh, has to be justified. What does it say in the pasuk? It says the following: Ubemos avia ve'ima, because of the death of both her father, meaning Esther's father, I don't know his name, but also her mother, her name was Avichayil, right? Then Mordechai lokcha lo labas. Mordechai adopts Esther in the wake or in the aftermath of Esther's loss of both her father and her mother. Now, the pasuk goes on to say, ki ela av va'em. So the Gemara is bothered by this. This is really an unnecessary repeat of what we already have. It says in the pasuk, ubimos avia v'ima. So obviously, she has no parents, and insofar as she's orphaned, v'lokcha lo labas, Mordechai adopts her. Why does the Tanakh have to say ki ein la av va'em? What is added to this? So the Gemara offers the following answer: that Esther was born without parents. Her father died while her mother was pregnant, and her mother died at childbirth. When Esther entered into this world, she was an orphan. Had it just said in the pasuk, "Ubimos avia ve'ima," we would not know exactly at what age she lost both her father and her mother. But because the Torah went out of its way to write ki ein la av ve'em, it's trying to tell me that at birth she entered into this world vi ein la av ve'em. So far, this is a very nice Gemara, but it's not relevant to us. Why does it become relevant to us? Because Rav Yosef Engel sees worlds in Rashi. So the entire structure of what we're about to enter into is predicated on Rashi, not on the Gemara itself. Now, as you know, Rashi very often will answer a question, 99 out of 100 times, without even asking it. And this is another such example. And somebody, I think, once wrote a book. I don't know if you've ever seen it. I never saw it, but it's called What Bothered Rashi. Did you ever hear such a book?
Yes.
Yeah. Who wrote it? Anybody know?
Funcher.
Funcher? Funcher. Avigdor Bunchik. Bunchik. Okay, Avigdor Bunchik. Is he here today? No, he's not here. Okay. So, because this would be a great example of what bothered Rashi. Now, if the point of the Megillah is to tell us that Mordechai and Esther had this relationship in which Esther was an adoptive daughter because she was an orphan, why is it necessary to tell us with an extra pasuk of of Ela Avaim? I'm just going to underline it so I can keep my eye will catch. Ki Ela Avaim, to tell us that at birth she was already an orphan. I mean, it's a very dramatic story. But why do we have to know this? I mean, it would seem to be superfluous because the whole point of the Megillah is to tell us why Mordechai adopted her. According to Rav Yosef Engel, Rashi is coming to answer this question. So let's read Rashi. Rashi says the following. Rashi says that as far as her father is concerned, when the pasuk says ki ein la av va'em, as far as the av is concerned, says Rashi, he was an av, But Eina Re'uya, says Rashi, Lihikaros Av. Rashi adds one word here. Lihikaros. Lihikaros means that the man on the street would not call him a father. Because in order to be a father, what do you need? You need a child. And he doesn't have a child because, tragically, he died before the child was born. But Rashi goes out of his way to say that we don't call him a father. Says Rav Yosef Engel, the implication of Rashi, and you'll see this a little clearer in a minute when he gets to the aim, is that really the father himself is a father, but nobody calls him such. Because since he died during the pregnancy stage and he never got to see his child, to live to see his child, he's not called a father. But fatherhood, says Rav Yosef Engel in reading into Rashi, is determined by the fact that his zera created a fetus, and that makes him roy to be an av. But eino roy li karos av, nobody's going to call him a father. Then Rashi gets to the next line. Eino ru'uya lios em. Here, when it gets to the mother, Rashi drops the word li'karos, and Rashi says that the reason why the Torah says, the Tanakh says, ki ein lo av ve'em, says Rashi, is because lo yolda, because she didn't give birth. What does it mean? She died before she gave birth. We're talking about the mother of Esther. So Rav Yosef Engel says, why the change in language? Rashi's trying to tell us that there's a fundamental difference between fatherhood and motherhood. Fatherhood is clinched, according to Halacha, the moment that there's a conceived embryo. But in the case of motherhood, motherhood depends upon Leda. If she dies before Leda, she's not considered the aim. So when the Pasuk says, ki ein la aim, what the Pasuk means to tell you is that halachically, there is no aim over here. This woman, namely Esther, is born without a mother. Why is she born without a mother? Because the mother did not live past the moment of Leda. Now again, I don't know exactly when she died. You know, the Gemara doesn't tell us this, but let's assume that she died 1 second before Leda. In that one split second, she, the mother, loses her status, or never achieves her status, if you will, of an aim. Why? Because of Leda. So watch what goes on here. This is what Rav Zalman Nechemya proves based on Rav Yosef Engel. In the case of the father, he became the father once she was pregnant, because he's responsible for that, right? We're not going to call him a father, obviously. The man on the street is not going to call him a father because Nebuchadnezzar's dead and buried and he doesn't have a child. But as far as motherhood is concerned, Rashi leaves out the word li'kares, li'kare aim, and Rashi says that since lo yolda, since she didn't give birth, she's not an aim. It comes out, says Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, that according to Rav Yosef Engel, motherhood depends upon birth. So even though Avichail is the genetic mother of Esther, nevertheless, halachically, she's not called an aim. Why? Because she didn't come to term. She was not alive at the time of the Leda. The Leda, therefore, doesn't relate to her. And if she's not the Yoledes, then she's not the aim. So says Rav Zalman Nechemya, let's take these two analyses together in context. We have Rabbi Kiva Eger, based on the Issa V'Heter, who says that if the trefa, since the cow who's a trefa is re'uya lihis aber, that makes it an aim, and the chalav is considered chalav aim, and it's included in the Issa of Basa B'chalav. So that means that becoming a mother depends upon pregnancy. On the other hand, we have Rabbi Yosef Engel in the context of the Gemara Megillah, who assumes that in order to become an aim, it's not enough pregnancy, it's not enough conception, but rather we need leda. So Rav Zalman Nechemya says that now we have two sources for this question, but they contradict each other. And therefore we come to no conclusion whatsoever. Here at this point, Rav Zalman Nechemya quotes a Gemara in Masechta Yevamos. Okay. And this, I believe, is on page 254. Let me just tell you quickly what the Gemara in Yevamos has to say. The Gemara wants to know about a case of a non-Jewish woman who becomes pregnant with twins. And then during the pregnancy, she converts to Judaism. Now, what happens is that the conversion process of the mother when she's pregnant expands and includes the children as well. Meaning, when the children are born, they are born as gerim. Why? That's based on a complicated principle called uber yerech imo. But leaving that out, the Gemara in Yevamos wants to know, what is the relationship between these two twins? These two twins fit into the following description halachically. Hora'asam shelo b'kedusha v'leidasam b'kedusha. In other words, the halacha doesn't recognize the relationship between these two young, let's say two boys, the twins are two boys. There's no brotherhood relationship of achva based on the hora, based on the conception. Because at the time of the conception, it was shelo b'kedusha, they were conceived to a non-Jewish mother. However, the Gemara concludes that these two brothers are considered brothers. And that means that, for example, if one of them would marry or have a relationship with the wife of the other brother, that would become an erva of what's called Eshes Achiv, the wife of his brother. That's an erva. Again, the only exception to that is in the case of Yibum. But in this case, there won't be Yibum because Yibum depends upon the Yichus of the father. So that there's no Yibum here, but yet the Gemara establishes a relationship of Achva as far as Yuchsin and as far as Erva is concerned between two brothers, twins, who were born to a Jewish mother, but she became Jewish at the time of the Leda. Says Rav Zalman Nechemya, this would seem to indicate that beyond a shadow of a doubt, Leda will determine motherhood. Meaning that these two brothers are considered brothers based on the fact that they have a common mother. They are maternal brothers. As far as the paternal element is concerned, that's completely gone. But as far as maternal element, since the mother underwent conversion, she became a Jewess with conversion. The boys are born as Jewish boys, and they are brothers related to their mother because of Leda. In this case, the conception could not possibly generate a relationship of achva, because as far as non-Jews are concerned, conception doesn't create achva. Again, there may be certain dinim, but there's no din of achos. You know, there are six arayas that apply even to a ben noach, but achos, but eshes achiv is not one of them. So as far as our discussion is concerned, forget about the father. That would not in any way be relevant. But as far as the mother is concerned, they are considered brothers, the Gemara establishes in Yevamos, because they're both born to the same mother. It would seem that motherhood, therefore, depends upon Leda. And at this point in the discussion, Rav Zalman Nechemya presents the following possibility. Based on the sugya of Chalav Trefa, which is considered Chalav Imo, even though she's Eda Ruyula Holin, we're going to say that a woman is a candidate to be called an aim based on genetics, meaning based on, how do you say in English, impregnation? Did I get that right?
Yeah.
Okay, impregnation, if there's such a word. And based on the sugya Yevamos, a woman becomes a mother because of Leda. So what it means is that you could possibly have a situation where a Jewish child has two mothers. Wow, I always say one mother is enough. But here's two mothers, right? You have one mother because she is the genetic mother, another mother because of the birth mother, and there's no contradiction between the two. Which would mean, halacha l'maaseh, according to Rav Zalman Nechemya, we're going to have to take the chumras of both. In other words, in terms of relationships and who's his sister and so forth and so on, we're going to have to tell this young man that either his sister from the genetic mother is an erva, or the sister from the birth mother is the erva. And this is absolutely fascinating, because basically what Rav Zalman Nechemya is coming up with is a double candidacy, so to speak, and you could become an aim in one of two ways. Now, the other possibility here would be to say that you need both. And some of the poskim are going to say you need both. You have to have both elements, which means that a person could be born not with two mothers, but with no mothers. So we have now four possibilities, I think, if I got the mathematics right. You might have one position that says that the genetic mother is the mother. Another possibility would say that the later mother is the mother. A third possibility would be to say that they're both mothers. And the fourth possibility would be that none of them are mothers, because we need both. And at this point in the discussion, We are so perplexed by this halacha that what enters in, you know, if I would invite into the room, agarta. Now, as I said at the outset, is it possible to derive halachic conclusions from agarta? And we quoted the Yerushalmi in Chagiga that we don't establish any halachic conclusions based on agarta. And if you look in the Encyclopedia Talmudic, he has a whole section in the very first volume. I think they're up to volume 40 already. But in the first volume, they have a whole section on agarta. And in that section, he quotes various poskim, beginning with Rabbi Kivager and others after him, who say that if there's no conclusion, if there's no definite way of quoting a Talmudic source to come to some halachic answer, because the halachic part of the Talmud is doesn't seem to give us a clear answer, then let's see what the agadat has in mind. Again, I have to emphasize, you can only use agadat when there's no clear answer in the Talmud. That's number one. And number two, if this agadat does not contradict the Talmud. And here we have an amazing statement in the Midrash. And this becomes relevant to our discussion. The Midrash says the following. The Pasuk says, Vateitze dina bas lea. Ashel Yolda Liyakov. Now, in this pasuk, you get the impression, that Dina is the daughter of Leah. However, the Chasam Sofer says that Dina is not the daughter of Leah. How can he say such a thing? So he quotes a Medrash. The Medrash says the following, that both Leah and Rachel were impregnated by Yaakov, more or less within a reasonable frame of time. However, here's the deal. Leah was impregnated with a male, whereas Rachel was impregnated with a female. And Leah turns to the Ribbono Shel Olam with the following prayer. She says, if I'm going to give birth to a male, that's going to be Yosef, then Rachel is in deep trouble. Even the Shvachos each had two children. And Rachel, and this is all Leah's Ruach HaKodesh, Rachel, if you cut out Yosef, would only have Binyamin, which means that she would be lower than the Shvachos. This would be absolutely humiliating to Rachel. Consider that Rachel humiliated herself for the sake of Leah. Now Leah is worrying about the humiliation of Rachel. And therefore, Leah turns to the Ribbono Shel Olam asking for a miracle. And God switches one embryo for the other embryo. There's a swap of embryos. So the male embryo, which is going to be Yosef, now gets swapped over from the uterus, from the womb of Leah, over to the womb of Rachel. And the female, that's Dina, who's in the embryo in the womb of Rachel, is now going to be transferred over to Leah. So that's what the Pasuk means when it says that Dina is born to Leah. The Leda was the Leda, from Leah's perspective, of Dina. Says the Chasam Sofer, when Dina goes out, Vateitze Dina, Reuven does nothing to save Dina. Reuven becomes, so to speak, motionless. Reuven was the one who at the time of the sale of Yosef got very excited, but here we don't find anything about Reuven. Says the Chasam Sofer, and I quote, Lo nilcham Reuven avur Dina ki chashav osa lebas Rachel. Very interesting. There was no relationship between Dina and Reuven. Why? At least in the mind of Reuven. Because since Dina was an embryo initially in the womb of Rachel, therefore she's considered the daughter of Rachel. Now hold on to your seats, because the plot grows thicker. By the way, I started a little bit late, so I'm going to add that extra 5 minutes. Is that okay? Okay, just to get to the punchline, 5 minutes. Okay. Now, after the story, the terrible episode of Dina with Shechem, nobody, according to the Midrash, nobody wanted to marry Dina. She was defiled. So who marries Dina? Shimon himself. Now the question is, if the Avos, when Makayim called it Tarkula before it was given, how was Shimon allowed to marry his sister Dina? So if you look in the Chochma Vidas, one of the super commentaries in Parshas Vayetze, he says the following, that since the Ibur of Dina took place in the womb of Rachel, and since Shimon was the son of Leah, therefore they were not maternal brother and sister, and he's allowed to marry her. They had the same father. So he says the following, that sometimes, again, this is very complicated, but just accept it right now, the principle is that if need be, although the Avos were Makayim Kol HaTorah Kula, if there's a very urgent need, then they're allowed to fall back on the laws of Bnei Noach. Now, in the laws of Bnei Noach, paternal brothers or brother and sister are not related to each other, because with regard to paternal relationships, that's only for Klal Yisrael, base of Osam. But with regard to non-Jews, the relationship is not generated by a common father, but rather by a common mother. Now in this case, Shimon and Dina did not have a common mother. Why? Because Rachel had the uterus, had the embryo of Dina in her body. Now, Rabosa, if we put this all together, number one, the fact that Reuven did not consider Dina to be his sister, because Reuven was born to Leah, and the fetus of Rachel was impregnated by Rachel in Rachel's womb, then the conclusion that we get to is that what generates motherhood?
Genetic.
That genetics generates motherhood. That Rachel is considered a mother insofar as she became impregnated with Dina. And that's an amazing conclusion, because although in Talmudic sources we've seen that it's very complicated and it goes back and forth and there's no clear-cut answer to this question, then if we activate the principle of Rabbi Kiveger and then Rabbi Avad Yosef and other poskim, that if there's no Talmudic conclusion in the halachic entity of Torah, then we rely on Midrashim, then if this Midrash is correct, that there's a mother-daughter relationship between Rachel and Dina, which would, number one, mean that Reuven doesn't get involved over here because he doesn't consider Dina his sister, and number two, that Shimon is allowed to marry what you and I would have thought was his maternal sister, but she's not his Shimon's maternal sister because Dina was impregnated in the body of Rachel, then we seem to come to the conclusion that it's the genetic mother who's the mother. Now watch this, and with this I'll conclude. Who is going to be the surrogate mother? If the surrogate mother is going to be a Jewish woman, we're in trouble. Because at least in Talmudic sources, there is room to believe, from the Gemara and Yevamos that we discussed at great length, that it is the birth mother who's considered the mother. And we're pushing the envelope here for fertility treatment in order to allow the genetic mother to be a mother, and together with her husband, to be parents of a child. However, all this is because the surrogate mother is Jewish. And the surrogate mother's Jewishness is able to engender a certain claim, so to speak, to motherhood. But that's not true in the case of a non-Jewish woman. So if the surrogate mother is a non-Jewish woman, and this is what I told my Talmud about 15 years ago, then the non-Jewish mother doesn't have any status as a mother vis-a-vis a Jewish child. And if that be the case, then the surrogate mother as a non-Jewess is basically an incubator, if you could say. It's like the case that I gave you before, where we took the embryo and we were able to grow it or mature it in a mechanical way. So the halachic status of a non-Jewish mother in terms of Jewishness is completely null and void. She's like an incubator. That's the only word I can use. And if that be the case, then we could certainly advocate in favor of surrogate motherhood, but with one condition. First of all, the condition is that the genetic mother has no other opportunity based on her physicality to give birth to the child. Secondly, based on the fact that we will specify that the surrogate mother would have to be a non-Jewish woman. So if she's a non-Jewish woman, her labor doesn't register, and then mimela we go back to the genetic mother. Now, it could be that the genetic mother is the mother even in the case of a Jewish woman who's a surrogate, because as we saw in Rav Zalman Nechemiah, initially based on Rav Kivega, he wanted to say that that motherhood depends upon genetics. But even if I'll tell you that genetics is not enough and you need Leda, that's only if there is a Leda. So if there's a mother for Leda, then she becomes sort of like a tug of war and she's claiming motherhood. But that's only true if she's a Jewish surrogate mother. If she's a non-Jewish surrogate mother, she has no claim to the Vlad as a mother. Is mamela we can fall back on genetic motherhood. And to be honest with you, I will tell you the following. And again, hopefully you won't fault me for saying it, but I feel intuitively that it's the genetic mother who's the mother. Now, it is true that science has determined that the surrogate mother does have an impact on the fetus. But the primary genetic code, the DNA, is the mother that's impregnated. And I can tell you this, that if you take a look at a child that was carried by a surrogate mother, you will see that child looks exactly like the parents, like his genetic mother. But how much is my intuition worth? I do not know. But I would say this, since there's no clear-cut Talmudic response, and the best we can do is to advocate in favor of a non-Jewish surrogate mother, and this is what I got from the rabbi to agree with me, let's institute what's called Geirus L'Hachmir. Geirus L'Chumra means that when this child is born, since we're not sure who the mother is, and if we would assume that the surrogate mother, who's not Jewish in this case, is the real mother, which again, I deny that that's so, but if you would push in that direction, let the child undergo Geirus. And in the worst case scenario, we'll consider him a Geir. Again, that has implications. But as far as the world is concerned, when we look at this child, and we may or may not know the whole history of the surrogacy, what we see is the child of the Jewish mother. And that's the way we're going to consider and treat the child. If you ask me, does the child have a status of a ger? We're going to have to assume l'chumra that the child is a ger because of this push amongst certain poskim that is indeed the surrogate mother whose leda brings this child to the world. She is the mother. And again, to go a step further and assume that applies even to a non-Jewish surrogate, based on that, we're going to require gerus luchum. Yiratzam v'vizocha, that all of our children will be able to fulfill the mitzvah peri v'rivia, and chas v'shalom, if need be, we always can rely on the modern technologies of infertility treatment, and will be zochem Yitz Hashem to fulfill all the halachas kedas Moshe v'Yisrael. Amen.